Sorry?
If this attorney thing doesn't work out, I can always...
Oh, that's right.
Both got a future.
Good morning, Counselor. Our next case is A18-1319, State of Minnesota versus Robert Michael Wendell. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for argument. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And whenever you're ready and have adjusted the podium, et cetera, state the name and the party you represent for the record.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Robert Wendell. Now, in my brief, I raised 5 claims challenging appellant's convictions and sentences in this case. Today, I would like to focus the court's attention on the first and the last issues raised in the brief, and time permitting, I would be happy to address any questions the court might have regarding the second through fourth issues.
So you want to talk about constructive amendment and criminal history score?
Correct, Your Honor. Got it. First, this court must reverse appellant's conviction for felony stalking because the district court's instructions to the jury regarding pattern of stalking conduct amounted to an impermissible constructive amendment of the complaint in violation of Rule 1705 and this court's holding in State versus Guerra.
When was the first time the defense had any notice that the prior incidents, which had been omitted as relationship evidence, were going to be proffered to the jury as a basis to find a pattern of stalking?
My understanding would be at the time that the state, shortly before the time the state submitted the proposed jury instruction for the court's consideration.
Were there any statements on the record in which the state put people on notice that it was going to rely on these prior relationship evidence incidents to prove a pattern of stalking?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. My understanding is that the only time that they were referenced was when discussed relative to whether or not they'd be admitted as relationship evidence.
Okay.
And so I think the key problem here is that the jury instruction allowed the juries to use those 4 incidents of prior criminal acts to prove an essential element of the stalking crime, acts that were not listed in detail in the complaint and were admitted exclusively, as this court points out, to illuminate the relationship between Mr. Wendell and VH, the alleged victim. Now, under the court's holding in Guerra, Mr. Wendell's conviction must be reversed if 2 things are present. The district court's jury instruction charges a different offense than the one charged in the criminal complaint, and if that amendment of the complaint affected the defendant's substantial rights. Now, here both are present. The jury instruction for pattern of stalking conduct charged a different offense for 3 reasons, and they're the same one cited in Guerra. First, the pattern of stalking conduct is an essential element of the charged offense, felony stalking. Second, the evidence that Mr. Wendell committed the qualifying acts on October 12th and 13th is different than the evidence that Mr. Wendell committed qualifying criminal acts on those dates between February 13th and January 2016. And now third, as in Guerra, the incidents charged in the jury instructions occurred at a different time and place than the offense charged in the complaint, which specifically listed that the stalking crime was committed on or about October 13th. Now, the district court's jury instructions regarding pattern of stalking conduct also affected Mr. Wendell's substantial rights. Now, this court looks at 3 factors to determine whether a constructive amendment affects substantial rights. First, it must find that as a result of the amendment, the defendant was not given proper notice of the charges. Second, it must find that the amendment affected defense counsel's trial tactic. And third, it has to find that the amendment confused the jury. And these are 3 factors that this court considers to determine whether or not substantial rights have been affected. There's no case law saying that all 3 necessarily have to be present. Now, here, Mr. Wendell did not receive proper notice from the state because the incidents occurring between February of 2013 and January of 2016 were not specifically described in the original or the amended complaint. Now, second, there was not adequate notice because Mr. Wendell was specifically told, assured by both the state and the court, that he was not going to be tried for those prior incidents. The court stated that on the record on the first day of trial, or it may have been the second day, depending on what you consider voir dire.
And now, was there, remind me, I believe there was a limiting instruction to the jury when this evidence came in about relationship evidence?
Not that I remember, Your Honor. Okay. I do not believe that there was a limiting instruction to the jury about the nature of what the evidence was coming in for. But the jury was told at the start of the trial that Mr. Wendell was being charged for incidents that occurred on or about October 13th, not any time before, not years before. Now, finally, Mr. Wendell's substantial rights were affected because this amendment affected defense counsel's trial tactic. And the nice thing we have here is defense counsel's testimony, basically, on this on the record as to why it affected his decisions during trial. Defense counsel indicated during his objection to the proposed jury instruction from the state that he had actually proceeded in this case with the understanding that Mr. Wendell was going to be defending against allegations of acts occurring on or about October 12th and 13th. Well, just 13th, we'll wrap October 12th into it. He stated further that he was with the understanding, the reasonable understanding, that the state would solely be introducing the evidence of the prior incidents, the incidents before October 12th, for relationship evidence purposes. And the state, tellingly, in its brief, ignores that fact. Now, third...
This is a minor thing, but is that just in figuring out all of these incidents, I think the April incident was not relationship evidence. Is that right? It came in through alleged hearsay or the police reports.
Well,
and
yeah,
so I'm just trying to... I know that gets into... But, you know, when it's the foundation of the pattern, you're saying that he believed the pattern even would only be the pattern as established by... by incidents on 10-12, 10-13, sort of irrespective of whether there's going to be relationship evidence? You're saying it was limited only, the pattern would only be what happened on those days?
Well, correct, or, Your Honor, I would argue that, well, to answer your question, yes. But I think the understanding is reasonable given how this crime was charged, given how the discussions about relationship evidence, you know, how they occurred, and given how what the state's opening statements were. I mean, they discussed pattern of stalking conduct, the crime that we are litigating as these incidents that occurred on October 12th and 13th, and everything else they call relationship
evidence.
So in
opening, the prosecutor said, we've got to prove a pattern. We're going to show you that these three things happen on these 2 days.
Nothing that explicit, Your Honor, but it talks primarily about what occurred on those 2 days, and then it just talks about we're going to show you some history of the relationship. It doesn't talk specifically about the incidents, just says we're going to show you the history there. And with regards to the point about the April incident, that was submitted for admission as both relationship evidence. But
what I thought the April incident is the one that was in the recording that was played during the police officer's testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I may be mistaken in my belief, but my understanding is that I'm challenging that submission in two different ways. I believe that the
state... I understand,
state,
but I think the confusion we're having is at one point in your brief, you say this April evidence clearly came in as relationship evidence. So it's like, well, I'm not so sure that's clear because... the district court said, I'm allowing these three things in, which not the April incident,
correct,
as relationship evidence. It sounds like the April incident just came in without any objection or discussion. Am I wrong?
I wouldn't say you're wrong. I think it's this issue was confusing. The April incident was disclosed to the party and the court as relationship evidence. Now, what I surmise happened was during the case,
during the course of writing before the trial?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. Again, I might be mistaken about the record. But my understanding is that it was disclosed and discussed as relationship evidence. What I believe happened is the state forgot to ask the witness about what happened on that date and then subsequently played a recording in which she commented on events occurring on that date. And that is why we're challenging that.
When the relationship evidence was proffered, there was an objection, there were arguments. No one mentioned this April incident.
I can look at the record.
You needn't look. We could check the record. I'm just recalling the record as indicating that this April incident wasn't grouped with the other three that were the subject of argument and ruling. You didn't take the time to look. We can review the record.
Okay, yeah.
I don't want to take your time.
I think my response is, I believe it was disclosed as relationship evidence, but even if it wasn't, it was not specifically listed in the complaint. And sure. So therefore there was inadequate notice. Now, if the court doesn't have any additional questions on the Guerra 1705 issue, I'd like to move into the sentencing claim that we make in this case.
On the sentencing claim, your argument is that if we were to determine that the state failed to meet its burden to prove that the Illinois offense was a felony that could be counted in the criminal history score, the record should not be reopened on remand. Do you have any authority to support that proposition?
I do, Your Honor. It's an unpublished case from this court that I failed to include in my brief. I did print out two copies. I found this last night, and I provided
the state with
a copy. It's a case called State versus Quinzar. Basically, this court very squarely addresses that issue, states if there is an objection to the out-of-state conviction, it deals with an out-of-state conviction, that the state basically does not get a second crack at it, doesn't get a second bite at the apple.
Did we give a reason?
This court cited to Maley, and we can talk about why this court may have cited to Maley and two additional published cases.
And what do those published cases say? Are those the published cases that say if there's no objection, get a do-over?
I mean, I think this case is the only case that I was able to find that squarely says that. And it compares the two different circumstances. It says, in the past, we have allowed the state to reopen the record if there is not an objection, but we do not allow that when there is an objection and the state has.
It seems to me this is an issue of first impression. It's sort of a big issue. And the questions I'm having is, generally speaking, if we have a criminal case and there's error, the case gets retried, you get a do-over. The only exception is if we're dealing with double jeopardy. And I don't see an argument that a sentencing error is akin to double jeopardy. Maybe, maybe not. But the other thing I'm thinking is, the whole purpose of the guidelines and an accurate criminal history score is so that we have consistency in sentencing. Therefore, a defendant can challenge the accuracy of his criminal history score at any time. Well, it seems like we'd want to look at it the other way and say, and so we want the criminal history score to be accurate, so why wouldn't we allow the record to be opened on remand to make sure it is accurate?
Right. And I would respond by saying this court has discretion to do one thing or the other. I don't think there's any binding case law that says that one thing or the other has to be done necessarily. I think under the principles of fairness, given the state has been given the opportunity to prove the out-of-state conviction, given that the defendant adamantly objected to that, the fact that the conviction exists.
Because you're short on time, just want to make sure that we understand. So the prosecutor comes to sentencing and says, look, I've talked with the probation officer, I've looked at some documents, and I believe he has this conviction and it's a felony.
Correct.
But no documents are actually made part of the record.
No,
and
Your
the
Honor.
Probation officer wasn't there, didn't testify.
No, Your Honor. And there was no explanation as to why there was
so
not
just
a certified
we have
or
a
uncertified
finding of a criminal history score based solely on the statements of a prosecutor.
The representations of the prosecutor, correct, Your Honor. So if the court doesn't have any additional questions, I would ask.
I do have one.
Of course.
Going back to the earlier discussion of the effect on substantial rights.
Of course.
You said it affected decisions during trial because of proceeding with the understanding that it dealt only with 1012 or 1013. Where have you described and what are the decisions that were affected during trial?
Well, the big argument is that the defense counsel did not really cross-examine at extent, to any particular extent, the existence of those incidents. So it seems as if you look through the entire record, there's perhaps one question that defense counsel asks about these prior incidents of the victim. I think in my brief I indicate that there are none, but I believe that there's at least one question, but it's a general overarching question, basically saying you came in and testified to these prior incidents. Some you reported and some you didn't. Isn't that correct? And the victim in this case says, the alleged victim in this case says yes. And that is the only question he asks. And I would submit that if these incidents were actually going to the, if he believed that these incidents were actually going to the an essential element of the offense, that he would ask more questions about it, as he did of the incidents that occurred on October 12th and October 13th.
And so it's the absence, of course, of cross-examination.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't presume to know what a trial attorney would do to try to rebut an assertion that particular things occurred 5 years back, but it's also possible that the defense attorney could have brought in witnesses to try to rebut what occurred in those prior incidents. And obviously here, the defense didn't actually put on any witnesses in the case.
Just quickly, Mr. Lau, if you can, the third issue with respect to the effect on substantial rights is confusion of the jury.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I don't know that you had time to really address that, but are you saying it's simply the verdict itself that would demonstrate that confusion, or is there something else?
In Guerra, there was actually a jury question that was submitted for the court's review, but I think...
We don't have that here.
We don't have that here, but there was also an instruction to the jury at the start of the trial that Mr. Wendell was being tried for incidents occurring on that specific date, October 13th of 2017. I would submit that there may have been some confusion by the fact that after given that instruction, the jury was told, well, you can consider all these things going back to 2013. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel John Schmidt, assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The appellant was properly convicted of domestic assault and stalking and properly sentenced, and we ask this court to affirm. Regarding the first issue regarding the jury instruction or constructive amendment, I in the brief noted that it should be viewed as a jury instruction. That was what the objection was to. I don't think there was a specific objection as to constructive amendment of the complaint, and so it should be abuse of discretion for the jury instruction. However, under either standard, this court should affirm. The complaint was very clear in the count and cited to the statute. The statute says it's stalking conduct within a 5-year period. That clearly gave the defense notice that this is talking about a 5-year period.
So under that theory, a defendant who served with this complaint knows that he should expect that anything he's ever done that might look like domestic assault could be presented to the jury to prove a pattern. And the state doesn't have to sort of identify specific incidents.
The state should identify specific incidents, and that did happen here. In the probable cause statement of the complaint, two specific incidents were noted with court case numbers after them in parentheses.
Right, but only one of those incidents was one of the prior relationship incidents. The prior relationship incidents, which were offered to the jury in the end as proof of a pattern, weren't identified in the complaint as the incidents which the state would rely on to prove the pattern.
The probable cause statement wasn't specific to say this incident for
right.
The 5-year domestic stalking, but I think that is enough notice to give notice to the defense that within the 5-year period of that statute, here are two of those incidents that you're on notice for that goes to that stalking.
I agree, but do you see my concern? If we accept sort of the district court's reasoning, which is, well, defendant should have known that anything he's ever done in the past 5 years is game. It's like, okay, but aren't there pleading requirements? Isn't there a due process right to have a pleading that is specific enough to put you on notice as to exactly what it is you're being charged with so you could prepare to defend it? And does this case sort of raise issues about, well, is it good enough to say, well, under the statute, it's a pattern of stalking, anything you've done that's not only domestic, but the pattern of stalking lists a lot of crimes. So if you're saying, you know, all you need to do is cite the pattern of stalking and 5-year look back period without actually having to specify what incidents the state is going to present to prove a pattern, is that sufficient notice to a defendant of how to prepare for trial?
Yes, because this goes to both relationship evidence and pattern of stalking. Now, it certainly could have been clearer that these two incidents noted in the complaints with court file numbers were going to be used to prove pattern of stalking.
Can we stop talking about those? Because I think everybody agrees those two incidents that were noted in the complaint are not the problem. The problem is the other three incidents that were not noted in the complaint, which were proffered by the state solely as relationship evidence to show the history of the relationship, and which were received for that reason, but which later became substantive proof of pattern of stalking.
So those other three incidents were also disclosed during discovery, and I don't know whether the disclosure
said... I understand that, but what I'm talking about, the notice that defendant claims is lacking is notice that the state was going to rely on these three incidents to prove a pattern of stalking, even though the state offered them solely for the purpose of showing the nature of the relationship, and even though they were received solely for that reason. So, I mean, I agree. He knows about these things. He knows they've happened. The issue seems to be he was told they were coming in for one reason, and then they were used for another, and they were used to prove substantive guilt, even though they weren't admitted for that purpose.
Sure, and certainly the state should have been clearer here in the complaint and the probable cause section.
When did the state decide to switch theories?
I don't know that they did. I think that it wasn't clear that this is for both, that this is relationship evidence and this is also the pattern of stalking, because
but
the defendant
didn't
was...
Didn't the state offer them and say, we're only offering this for proof of the prior relationship? And the court said, yes, they're received for that purpose. We're not going to dwell on this. He's not on trial for those prior incidents. But then the jury instructions put him on trial for those prior incidents.
The jury instructions did say within the 5-year period that any acts within 5-year period look back, and so I don't recall, you had asked some questions about the record before. I don't recall exactly what the notice was, but I do know that it's on the second volume of the transcripts at 36 through 51 in the record. But I don't recall exactly that discussion about the relationship evidence, but. The state should have been clearer, but the defendant was clearly on notice that anything within that 5-year period could be used against him based on the complaint itself. And if you take those two acts that are in the complaint and you take what occurred on October 12th and October 13th, the evidence is sufficient to show that he was properly convicted and his substantial rights were not affected by this.
Isn't it a fair argument, though, that defense strategy would have been different in terms of cross-examination or other choices that counsel might have made had they known that those incidents would be considered as part of a pattern, ultimately?
I don't think so, because in this case, we're talking about police report interactions where the police were there arresting people. There may have been additional witnesses that came about. We may have had to call the police from those specific incidents to come testify that, yes, I arrested this defendant because of this domestic assault issue. But no, I don't think that the, given that these were specific police-involved domestic assault incidences, I don't see what trial strategy would have been different on cross-examination, given that some of these resulted in orders for protection, some of these were violations of orders for protection, that there are documented evidence of all of this. So I don't see where that would have been different, and likely, I'm not going to speculate on what the defense would do on that, of whether there could be more harmed by that, by trying to get into that more. But Under either theory, whether this is a jury instruction or constructive amendment, I do think that the two incidents noted in the complaint and what happened on October 12th and 13th is sufficient to affirm, because on October 12th, he was there, he was told to leave, the police had to come and take him out of the house. The testimony, which was unrefuted, was that he came back and was outside pacing around the door and voluntarily left. And he came back a third time on October 13th when the police had to come and arrest him to get him to leave. So between the three incidents on October 12th and 13th, plus the two that are noted in the complaint, is sufficient for the to affirm the conviction based on pattern of stalking. Unless the
two that are noted in the complaint, do you mean the two order for protection violations?
Yes.
Okay. And those were presented to the jury by way of stipulation?
No, those were, one of those was came in through, I believe, came in through the officer's testimony, the recorded conversation. And that came in through, and I know appellant is challenging that on other grounds, but the victim testified that she had experienced multiple incidents of domestic abuse. That came in and supported that testimony.
So your argument seems to be on prejudice. Even you could ignore the relationship evidence, even if that isn't considered. There is enough other evidence here to prove a pattern of stalking.
Correct.
Okay.
Briefly on the...
And is your argument on that that just the two cited in the complaint are enough? You don't even need to get to the 10, 12, 10, 13 events to find a pattern?
You need two in the last 5 years.
Right.
And so long as those two, and honestly, I can't recall whether both of those were admitted. I've been sick this week, and so I haven't dug into that specifically. But as long as those two were put before the jury, then that would be sufficient.
Were those two in the jury instruction? For some reason, I'm thinking only
I
one
think,
of the OFP
I believe
violation.
Only one of the two.
Okay. So even though the complaint says here's two priors that could be used...
Correct.
Only the jury was only instructed on one of those.
I think that's right. Okay. That's my recollection, that only one of those came in. So I think then you would need...
One more that's not in the complaint.
Correct. Which could be the October 12th trespass where the police had to come and remove him from the property when he refused to go because she asked him multiple times to leave. He decided to go take a nap in her bed, and then the police came and removed him from the house. That could be the second within the 5 years.
What about the other challenge to the jury instruction that the way the district court worded it, it wasn't made clear to the jury that it must find at least two of the prior offenses had been proved beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that goes to issue four. No. The district court's instructions on that were clear that it did say you need to find these beyond a reasonable doubt. There is, that's earlier in the instruction.
Well, the district court said you have to find a pattern beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
But then said you don't, what was the instruction? The district court didn't make it clear. The district court said you don't have to all agree on which of these offenses occurred, but you have to agree to two. And doesn't really specify that, and you must agree to those two beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct. Yeah, the district court, so I found it here, on 257 said you must prove a pattern of stalking beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury must agree that more than one criminal act occurred.
But don't skip over the next line. The state must prove the pattern of stalking conduct beyond a reasonable doubt, but it is not required to prove each separate criminal act beyond a reasonable doubt for this charge. It's true, but actually, you don't have to prove all of them, but you do have to prove two.
You have to prove two, and I maybe that was not worded well enough, but that is consistent with the Bustos case.
But the thing is, though, the jury hasn't read the Bustos case, and probably most of them aren't lawyers. So my concern is it's easy for us to say, well, we kind of get what the district court was trying to say because we know the law. These are 12 people that probably don't know the law, and they've just been told, what was the second line?
It is not required to prove each separate criminal act beyond a reasonable doubt.
I mean, doesn't that fairly communicate that you don't need to find any of these separate acts beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, for this particular jury instruction, now we're under a plain error analysis, and so it has to be an error that is clearly plain.
Well, it's plain under Bustos, because Bustos says you have to prove two beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I would disagree, and I think that what the wording that the court is trying to say here is that you can disagree on which two you use,
but you need two. And you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which was the first intro to that.
I think we would agree that that's what the court was trying to say. The concern is I don't know that that instruction says that.
Well, and again, this is where we're under the plain error analysis, and I don't think that this is an error that is plain that affects the defendant's substantial rights. I don't think this meets the test of the plain error analysis to get there. This is under the issue three that the appellant raised. So it's a higher burden than that. Briefly, I'd like to turn to the sentencing issue that the appellant raised. Although I would be remiss, I do want to quickly mention issue two about the sufficiency of the evidence. The appellant's argument is that the defendant was there to retrieve his children, and that's a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt. And frankly, that's not reasonable, and it's not a rational hypothesis other than guilt. He was there at 3 in the morning. He had no legal right or custody agreement for these children. This was a Thursday night on a school night to take an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old from their beds at 3 a.m. So the argument is basically that he's going to kidnap these children, and that's a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt, and it simply is not.
Hey, do you have any authority for the proposition that a prosecutor's representation to the court regarding level of a out-of-state conviction is sufficient proof of the out-of-state conviction to satisfy the guidelines requirements that it be a felony based on element comparison and that he received a sentence that would be a felony in Minnesota?
The objection that was raised below was about whether he was convicted or not, and the defendant was adamant that he had not been convicted. My reading of the record shows that the district court looked at the documents, although did not accept them into evidence. And by looking at the documents, the district court disagreed in an argument with the defendant.
The problem is on what documents? If they're not received in evidence, we can't look at those documents to make a determination whether or not the evidence was sufficient to prove the out-of-state conviction.
Correct. And the documents were not received in the evidence. And the court said, the documents show otherwise that you were convicted. And the documents were, as the record established,
complaint.
A copy of the complaint and the register of action from Cook County. Now, Cook County is notoriously hard to get records from. And so what they did was what they could do the best with what they had was get the complaint, get the register of actions, show that it was convicted. Here's the elements of the offense, show that he was convicted of that defense. The court accepted that as enough. The state should have offered the complaint.
How do we review that? I understand that the district court accepted it as good enough, but how do we determine whether it was good enough if we don't have the documents?
Well, and that gets into whether the district court abused its discretion by not accepting that into evidence. The district court, by my reading, and I see I'm out of time, By my reading, the court did look at these, did make the determination that, yes, you were convicted of this crime. The state should have offered that to give this court the proper record. And if I may briefly comment on the case about the remand to open the evidence. I see I'm out of time, but...
No, go ahead.
So counsel did give me the case this morning, and I appreciate that. My very quick reading of this case is that there is a fact dispute in that about the elements of the crime and whether the person was in custody or not when they fled. The state tried to prove that fact by a preponderance of evidence at the hearing, failed to do so. This is a different situation where the state had the documents in hand, failed to submit that in evidence. So I think that case could be distinguished to allow a remand for reopening the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to sort of piggyback on that last point, I do not believe that there is a distinction between Quenzar and the present case to the extent that the court is going to rely on Quenzar.
Can you spell Quenzar?
Quenzar.
Okay.
So, and the reason I say that is because in both cases, the state has a burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence three things: the existence of the conviction, that the crime from the out-of-state, the crime out-of-state has the equivalency here in Minnesota, and that the sentence was a felony sentence. The state was put on notice that it needed to prove those three things in this case. When the defendant objected to it, the state actually represented to the court that it would, that it in fact would, at the end of the trial, in this case, and then it failed to do it. And so,
you're essentially equating that with failure to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in terms of the remedy. Is this a double jeopardy issue?
That we have not raised it that way, Your Honor. My only point is...
I'm just wondering out loud if it is, because
no.
If it's not, I mean, I don't know how you get there.
My reliance is largely on Quinzar.
Unpublished
case, correct, Your Honor. Now, with regards to the first issue, back to that...
Can I clarify something on the first issue?
Of course.
So we were talking about that there are two prior incidents identified in a complaint.
Correct, Your Honor.
One of those was submitted to the jury in order to prove pattern.
Correct, Your Honor.
My understanding of your argument from your oral argument earlier is you don't think either of those prior incidents should have been included.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
And you don't think so, if I understood, because in opening statement, the prosecution said, well, we're trying to prove what happened on October 12th and 13th, and so forget about what's in the complaint. I didn't have notice of that one because the opening told me something else.
I think that's it's not the opening, it's the relationship evidence. The discussion about whether or not that would be coming in as relationship evidence or evidence to prove an element. Now, in addition to that,
so
court
even though it was noticed in the complaint as a prior one, it was talked about in the context of the relationship
right.
evidence.
We are not disputing the fact that it was in the complaint, but I think the court should also be aware or know that in the original complaint that did not charge the stalking, it included those two OFP violations, meaning...
The OFP violations were probably there from the get-go to show a felony domestic assault.
Correct.
Those are the predicate enhancements for the felony domestic.
Correct.
One of those... And he stipulated to those.
Correct, Your Honor.
One of those also comes in as
relationship
evidence.
But no one ever discusses it as evidence to prove the stalking crime until the state submits the proposed jury instructions. And I think the defense attorney actually makes that objection, which goes to the state's point about the test, the appropriate test for this case. This is a challenge to the district court's jury instruction. It's just a special type. And given the nature of the challenge, this court's holding in Guerra, the Supreme Court's holding in Verney, the Supreme Court's holding in this court's holding in Manley and the Supreme Court's holding in Gesegi, those cases apply here because it's a specific type of jury instruction and that modified test applies. Now, separate and apart from that, this court earlier, I believe it was Judge Smith, asked what could have potentially been different if the defendant had been properly noticed. Well, if the defendant had properly been advised, not only could he have called additional witnesses, he himself may have chosen to testify because he would have perhaps been the only other witness to this incident. But he may have chosen not to, thinking that, well, this being relationship evidence, it's not substantial enough for me to actually get on the stand. And that has all sorts of wide-ranging implications. Now, finally, the state keeps pointing out that, well, this could have been clear, but it was clear enough. The point of the specificity of the charging requirement is that so the defendant is aware of what he is charged with. That is why there is the 1705 prohibition, is so that the defendant is not surprised after he has already put on his case that some other things might come in. So for all those reasons, I'd ask this court, and those reasons stated in my brief, I'd ask this court to reverse Mr. Wendell's convictions for stalking and domestic assault and to reverse his sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within a statutory time frame. Thank you.